Florida lawmakers missed their deadline. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
And we will keep you posted as to what our timing is in terms of extending to get it done. We're still working on that with staff and trying to figure out how long it takes.
The legislative session is supposed to end tomorrow, but it won't because the House and Senate didn't finalize their budget in time. Florida law says they need a 72-hour cooling-off period, so this will go into next week. We'll get the latest from the Capitol. Flamenco means singing, guitar playing, and dancing. It's sensual and captivating in its movement and color, and we'll talk to one of Spain's most famous flamenco dancers. And then we're going to talk to two world-class Cuban jazz artists, a percussionist and a pianist, who are expanding their musical boundaries in different ways. They're all performing here in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the 2018 Florida legislative session is this close to being finished. Tomorrow was supposed to be the official end, but because it took so long for both chambers to reach a budget agreement, they're going into extra innings. Before the session started, the focus was expected to be the governor's budget.
In my budget this year, I'll cut $180 million for the taxes. In a recession, your taxes and your fees should not be going up. Back in 2009, in the middle of a recession, the politicians in Tallahassee raised the fee for driver's license from $20 to $48. I want to take that back down. I want to make sure we have sales tax holidays for getting our kids ready to get back to school, preparing for hurricanes. So I look forward to working with the legislature, but I'm going to fight for tax reduction.
All right, that was the governor back in October of 2017. And of course, the Parkland shooting 3 weeks ago has changed everything and put gun legislation on the agenda. Yesterday, the Florida House passed its version of the much-debated gun bill. WLRN's education reporter Jessica Bakeman is in Tallahassee, joins us via Skype. Jessica, always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go over the House gun legislation that passed yesterday. It's the first gun control law that the House has passed in over 20 years. What are the specifics of the bill?
Well, the bill has now passed both chambers, and so the only step that is keeping it right now from being called a law is the governor's signature. I know we'll talk about that in a second, but just to go over the details, it's 100 pages, so you know it's pretty comprehensive. There's a lot of different elements. As far as the gun aspects of it, it includes a 3-day waiting period before you can purchase a gun, which is intended to allow more time for a thorough background check to be completed before someone is able to buy a gun. It also raises the age for purchasing guns from 18 to 21, and it bans the sale and possession of bump fire stocks, which is an accessory that can be used to make a gun fire more rapidly.
And also the bill, this is the controversial part. It allows some teachers and school staff to carry guns on campus. Was that as controversial in the House as it was in the Senate?
I would say it was even more controversial in the House. In the House, there's a strong, outspoken Black caucus that many members of which spoke out against this provision in particular during hours and hours of debate, both yesterday and the day before, because it's a 2-day process to pass a bill. And the arguments that they were making was basically, you know, we've seen this problem with police shootings of unarmed Black people. And also they listed many examples of when the Stand Your Ground law has been used to help someone get off after they have shot or killed, in many cases, a person of color. And so they said they don't want to see those kinds of scenarios happening in classrooms where teachers or people in other positions of authority at schools are armed and could potentially lead to accidentally or even purposefully, in a heated moment of confrontation, shoot and kill a Black or brown child.
And there were parents from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in Tallahassee, and they were talking to lawmakers yesterday about this. What did we hear from them? What were they saying to the lawmakers?
They said they were united in support of the bill, that it wasn't perfect, but not everything can be perfect, and that they needed to just put aside whatever political agendas they had and pass it. And they've had basically the same message to the governor, which is, please sign this bill. They think that it's not enough. They want more, but they didn't want the bill to get voted down and risk nothing happening at all because it didn't do absolutely everything they wanted.
Now, what have we heard from students about all, you know, what the Senate and what the House have passed?
Something of a similar message. I've been following the students on Twitter, the ones who've been especially outspoken about the Never Again movement, the ones that are planning the March for Our Lives. And they've basically had similar comments like, you know, this doesn't do as much as we'd like. We wish it did more. It's just a little bit of a start, but it's a good start, basically.
All right. What has the governor said about whether or not he's going to sign this, or do we know?
He's not saying. He's had his sort of standard answer about legislation, which is, when it gets to my desk, I'll review it. Yesterday, he said, I'm going to do what the people in Washington aren't doing, which is read every line of the bill and really make sure that I know what's in it and understand it before I make a decision. But he did say that what the families want is going to weigh heavily on his decision. Obviously, we know that they are asking for him to sign it. And I've just heard that he has invited some of the families to the Capitol tomorrow. And so it looks like that decision could come as soon as tomorrow.
How much did the Parkland shooting and the pressure from families and students of Marjory Stoneman Douglas change this legislature and how it does business?
Well, it completely changed this legislative session in particular, for sure. I mean, lawmakers said that over and over and over again throughout debate, that, you know, this happened and they sort of dropped everything and came up with this massive bill. And, you know, from the day the shooting happened to the day that they passed it was 3 weeks, which is a really short period of time in terms of the legislature. And obviously that's, you know, bills that are easier to go through the legislature because they're less controversial take lots more time than that. And this bill in particular, because it had, you know, those increased restrictions on gun purchases, which was difficult for some Republicans to support because their bases of voters are very, you know, strongly motivated by the Second Amendment. And, you know, on the other end, you know, the fact that there was the provision that allows some school staff to be armed was difficult for a lot of Democrats to vote for. And yet 3 weeks later, they passed it and the governor's looking at maybe signing it tomorrow.
All right. Legislators finally reached a deal on the budget. It was late, which means the session has to go past Friday, the last scheduled day. Governor Scott had a bigger spending plan this year compared to past years. What did the chamber send him?
Well, you know, it's interesting because yesterday there were different points throughout the day where the lawmakers who are in charge of the budget, the chairs of the Appropriations Committee, and also the leaders of each legislative chamber said, we've got a deal, we've got a deal, we've got a deal, and started talking about all the different aspects of it. But the thing is, they don't really have a deal until they print the budget. And that is happening pretty much right now. There were still budget meetings last night and this morning. And so now they're finally finalizing it, which is what triggers the 72-hour cooling off period, which means that, you know, it's still a little bit unclear as to exactly when they're going to vote on the budget. But the exact details, I haven't had time to go through and look at all of the specifics, but based on what they've been talking about over the last several weeks, the legislature actually was on board with doing a budget that was pretty much as big as what the governor was looking for. They were kind of all talking about in the range of $87 billion. And I know I've looked specifically at what they're talking about as far as funding for public schools, and it's $21 billion, which is an increase of about $485 million, you know, which, as these things always go, some people will say is enough and some people will say is not nearly enough to meet the needs of public schools.
All right, let's go back over one of the highly contentious bills, House Bill 7055. Briefly remind us what that's about.
So this is a huge education bill that was the chief priority of House Speaker Richard Corcoran. And as you remember, many people compared it to House Bill 7069, which was his priority last year. There was a lot in it, but the most controversial provision in it is one that targets teachers' unions specifically. Basically, it says that if at least 50% of the people who are eligible to be in your union are in it and paying dues, then, you know, you can continue to be their union. But if it's under 50%, then you might have to reapply for certification, and you might lose the opportunity to do the collective bargaining on behalf of those union members. And so that in the Senate led to the vote being really close. And there was actually an amendment that was proposed to take that out that failed on a tie, 19 to 19. There's 40 members in the Senate, but there's two vacancies right now. So you can see how that specific provision almost made this bill not go through at all in the Senate. And then, you know, they made a couple of changes, including they added a provision that will exempt Marjorie Stoneman Douglas high school students from having to take state testing this year. They sent it back over to the House, and the House pretty easily sent it to the governor. It was kind of a whirlwind the last several days of session, the end of last week and the beginning of this week, because while they were doing all of this negotiation and voting and debating over the gun bill, they also were just like quickly sending all of these other really important big bills to the governor's desk and dealing with the budget behind the scenes. So it's been a whirlwind for sure.
All right. There's one thing that's gotten a bit of attention, I should say. It's the fact that the legislature passed the end of daylight savings time. Is there any idea if the governor's going to sign this?
You know, I really don't know if the governor's going to sign it. I believe he has said what he, like I said, always says, which is, you know, he'll look at the bill when he gets it. But House Speaker Richard Corcoran did make a comment about it on the floor yesterday during they do all of these farewell addresses for all of the lawmakers who are leaving either because they're term limited or they're not running for reelection. And during one of those, he was talking about how this idea had come up for this bill to take Florida, you know, out of the daylight savings time. And he said that it was an idea that had come up, but he had said, no, let's not do this because we're not in control in Congress, meaning Republicans. And so they finally did it this year because, you know, we have a Republican president, you know, so now we have a Republican president. And so they're looking at trying to make it happen, but it has to, even if the governor does sign it, it has to be approved in Congress, and they're not sure that that's going to happen. So we'll see.
It just sounds like I have to do a whole nother show just about that. All right, let's finish up with this. Governor Scott gets the last word. Is he likely going to use his line item veto on anything?
Oh, of course he will. He always does. I think he absolutely will use it on something. We'll see what he uses it on. What's interesting is that, you know, people keep talking about, okay, is he going to sign this gun bill? And I think everyone thinks he will, especially given that all of the families are saying that he wants them to do it. Obviously, the aspect of the bill that he has been most concerned about is the program that would arm some school staff. He has said over and over again he's against arming teachers specifically. He said it was a step in the right direction that the Senate made this change that ultimately ended up in the final bill that says exclusively classroom teachers would not be eligible to carry guns, but there would still be some teachers who could if there are teachers who, for example, are coaches or have some other position. And so some have suggested that what governor might do is he might sign the bill, but he might veto the funding for that program in the budget, which would render it, you know, ineffective. And so that, I think, is the thing that we will be watching for specifically.
Again, I've been talking with WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman, joining us via Skype at the Capitol in Tallahassee. I can even hear the lobbyists in the background. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Still to come on the program, a closer look at the art of the flamenco dance. That's all next here on Sundial on WLRN. Hello and welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and just some of the beautiful flamenco music, and that just teases up what we're about to do. South Florida's annual Flamenco Festival starts tonight at the Arts Center in downtown Miami. With me in studio, one of Spain's best-known flamenco dancers, Antonio Najarro. I'm going to say that right. I apologize. He's a choreographer, too, and artistic director of the Ballet Nacional de España. And even if you've never seen a flamenco performance, you have seen some of his choreography. If you watch the Winter Olympics, you'll know. We're going to get into that and more.
Wow.
Also, I want to mention too, by the way, go to Facebook. Find us on Facebook right now, WLR and Sundial. And I did post up a video. It was the 2002 Winter Olympics, and it was the gold medal winning performance. And again, he had his hand in that. But we're going to talk about that and more. Antonio, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Did you start your career with flamenco or some other kind of dancing?
I started my career in the south of Spain, in Malaga, when I was very young, when I was 6 years old. I discovered...
Six
years old.
Wow.
I discovered the feria in Malaga. It's like where everybody in the street is dancing. I could hear the sound of the cajon flamenco guitar, singers, and I was really impressed about that. And I start to feel that I preferred to move than to speak. I was very, very shy, and my parents saw that, and I started very, very young my career.
And when you start, I mean, at that age, does that mean, when you say you start, does that mean that you started schooling
for
dance? Really?
The career, I start at the age of 8 years old. The dance career in Spain is 11 years. And so I started at 8 years. But it's very, very important for me to point that the Spanish dance is not only flamenco. We have four different styles of dance. We do a lot of classic ballet every day, 1 hour and a half of ballet, classic ballet. And we have escuela bolera, danza estilizada, folklore, and flamenco. Four different styles of dance.
And so you study that over 11 years.
Yeah.
My goodness. Focusing on flamenco, though, how do you describe flamenco to, you know, anybody who doesn't know it, or they've only just barely heard a little bit about it, but they don't really understand it?
The real flamenco, what we dance in the theaters around the world, it's a very, very difficult and complex technique of dance. We need to have a very strong technique in ballet classic, in footwork, in castanets. Castanets is an instrument that maybe somebody knows about that. They think that it's two wood pieces in the hands, but it's really an instrument. We do we play 11 years every day castanets to improve. It's like violin, it's like piano, and it's very, very difficult. So we need also to play castanets in a very, very good way, and we need to have a great technique: pirouettes, jumps, footwork. And a part of all of this technique, we dance about an expression. It's very important. Soul, Spanish soul, Spanish expression. It's real. It's not a caricature. It's something very profound from the earth. And we need to have all this technique to be ready to express all the sentiments, all the sensibility on the stage, forgetting the technique.
Well, if you have enough,
I don't know if you understand. Sorry for my English.
Oh, yes, no. The other thing too, I think about when I think about flamenco anyway, is how colorful it is.
Yeah,
it's the outfits that the men and women are, the dancers, all the dancers are wearing. That's an important part too.
Yeah, of course. The all the costumes and all the costume designs that we get in flamenco, they are very important. We dress traditional costumes, but the flamenco today is really very, very, very modern. We use different fashion designers. I use for the Ballet Nacional de España fashion. I work with fashion designers around the world, French, American, and we mixed the painting, the cinema, the music. We use jazz and oriental music with flamenco. We love to mix all the different styles. So we have a very modern vision.
Again, I'm speaking with Antonio Najarro. He is the choreographer and the artistic director of the Ballet Nacional de España. And again, they're going to be performing at the Arts Center in downtown Miami. It starts tonight. We'll have more information, by the way, online, so you could find it and learn more about it. It is the Flamenco Festival, which starts tonight. For this show, how do you describe to audiences what they can expect mm-hmm. when they come in? What are they going to see? What are they going to experience?
Mm-hmm. Sweet Sevilla was my first show when I started to direct the Spanish National Ballet in 2011. And I was seduced by the music composition of Rafael Riqueni. He's a composer and flamenco guitarist, very famous in Spain. And I was seduced by this music, and I started to create a show with a very traditional base, because the show speaks about the city of Sevilla, the arena of Sevilla, the Guadalquivir River of Sevilla, the holiday in Sevilla, all the traditional elements of this city, which are also the traditional elements of Spanish vision, religion, weather, how we see. We have a very particular vision of life. Everybody thinks that we are always having fun, but it's not true. But it's true that the religion, for example, we have a very strong vision about the religion. So we do the pasos, the procesiones with the Virgin and Jesus Christ in the street. It's a very, very special. You can believe or not believe, or you can be religious or not, but as cultural activity of Spain is very interesting. So all these elements are reflected in Sweet Sevilla. So all these traditional elements are described in a very modern choreography and very modern dress. And I think this is what does the Sweet Sevilla very special, because audience will see the tradition. From where we come in flamenco, but also they will see where we can go or where I want to go with my choreography.
I wondered what it's like for you when you're creating this choreography for many dancers. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine it's already challenging enough when you have two. Mm-hmm. But tell me what it's like for you as you're trying to, you know, create the show with all of these performers that are going on at the stage at the same time.
Mm-hmm. No, Sweet Sevilla is composed by 14 different numbers. There is not an argument from the beginning to the end. So, but each choreography has a feeling, has a spirit, different spirit, and each number speak about one color of Sevilla. With a pas de deux, with solo dance, with group numbers, and I studied the rhythm of the. For me, it's very important the rhythm of the show. So there is a first number starting with 30 dancers on the stage, clapping castanets on the floor, and after that there is a solo number of Escuela Bolera, very technique, very it's a very difficult number. After that, a pas de deux with the bullfire, with a woman who is playing the role of bull and woman at the same time, playing with the sentiments of the torero, and the whole show go with men numbers, girls numbers, pas de deux, solo, and of course at the end there is a huge number with 40 dancers on the stage.
You talk about tradition, and I had to go back because I didn't know enough about the history of flamenco. I wanted to go back and understand it. Mm-hmm. This goes back centuries, but it's also been influenced by so many different other cultures, right?
Of course. For example, the Arabic culture. When you hear the singing of Arabian people, you can really hear flamenco singing. Is very, very similar, and we have also a lot of influence about Indian instruments, percussion instruments. The history, when the Arabic culture went to Spain, and we can feel also in the architecture of Cordoba, Granada with the Alhambra, and all these points are influencing the flamenco in that period, and after that we started our own evolution.
All right, so I have to bring this up because I said it at the beginning. You have another career. You choreograph ice dancing. How did you start working in that?
So it was in 2000. I was younger than now.
We all were, but that's okay.
The French couple, Marina Anissina and Wendal Peyserat, they were a world champion in that moment. And they were looking for a flamenco program to present in 2002 Salt Lake City Olympic Games. So when they offered me this, they saw my works in the Spanish National Ballet. I was dancer there I was principal dancer in the Spanish National Ballet in that period, and I created some choreographies, and they saw it and they found interesting. So they contacted me, and they told me, Antonio, we would like to show a flamenco program on ice. So when they told me that, I was, oh my God, how can I do it? You know, the flamenco is wave, is on the floor. We are clapping with our footwork, and it's something completely different to the feeling of to be on the ice, which is, it's a win, you know, it's very, I don't know the name in English. It's another feeling. It's like we're flying, you know. But I said yes, because I like to take a risk, and I like to open the vision of the flamenco in everywhere.
What did you find was the biggest challenge, though? Because as you said, so flamenco is very much, you know, it's weighty. It's on the ground, mm-hmm. and again, ice skating, you're gliding. Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge in trying to mix the two then?
For me, it was to make the skaters feel what we feel when we dance flamenco, you know, to feel the floor, the energy when you are, because we really need to feel the energy of the floor when we are clapping, you know. So I started working with them on this ballet class, like real dancers with flamenco shoes. And I was working 2 years with them about the footwork, movements of hands, movement of arms, flamenco positions. And 1 year, and after 1 year, I started to work with them with the energy, you know, the eyes, the right. feeling, you everything. And after that, we went on the ice. And I start to build really a dance choreography, forgetting their own mechanic movements of ice skating. And the result was the world gold medal. And it was the beginning of a very interesting career for me.
All right. So I pulled a clip from that performance. And this is right after that performance. This is this sound comes from NBC Sports. And, you know, the announcers were talking about how they were just really just blown away by everything. But this is part of that clip.
Anissina and Peyserat of France, do you think their 3 trips to Madrid to work with the flamenco dancers showed up in this program?
Absolutely. I think that program is a masterpiece. It has complex choreography, hidden difficulties, and they were so true to the character of the dance.
You know, it was beautiful to watch. And the other thing, too, is the fact that, you know, the outfits, especially the with the female, she's wearing this mm-hmm. dress, mm-hmm. which did get in the way for other ice skaters when they've tried it, you know, since mm-hmm. because, you know, with the movements that you have to do on the ice, and you have this dress that can get in the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, after you saw that, after, you know, you work with them for 2 years, after you watch their performance, what were you thinking about? Were you there, by the way?
Sorry?
Were you there at that
moment? No, I was not there.
But did you got to see it?
Of course.
Tell me that moment after you watched
it. I was crying and crying and crying because I really... You know what? I was not crying because the gold medal. I was crying because I really saw 2 flamenco dancers on the ice, and for me it was the best gold medal for me. You know, and that's why after that, many skaters, Olympic skaters like Evgeny Plyshenko, many couples, American couples, Canadian couples, Spanish couples, Stefan Lambiel, now Javier Fernandez, the actual world champion and bronze medalist, Olympic medalist, they wanted to work with me because they like how I treat the skaters as a real dancers, because it's artistic skating, and I think that it must be... It must be really, you must really see like dancers on the ice.
How do you feel about the fact that you have had this, going back to 2002, that you've had this impact
on the world of figure skating, because mm-hmm. now they're looking to you. Mm-hmm. And if anything, they're just looking to this style mm-hmm. because it could be so powerful on the ice. Well, how do you, you've had this massive influence.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the power of the dance was in the ice skating, you know? I love to see how an art can change a sport. You know, it's for me, it's amazing. I think art can change everything, can change the society, can change your mentality. It's very good to think about the art, and if it's dance, better for me.
The Flamenco Festival again starts tonight at the Adrian Arsh Center in downtown Miami. It's South Florida's annual Flamenco Festival. We've been talking with Spain's best-known flamenco dancer, Antonio Najarro. Again, he is also the artistic director of the Ballet Nacional de España. And we're going to have more information on the festival on our website. So if anything, please check it out and let us know if you do go. Let us know what you think about it. Antonio, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, still to come, a little bit of Cuban jazz. We'll switch things up and have some fun here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and if you want to add some Cuban music to your week, the Global Cuban Fest starts Sunday in Miami, featuring the music of the Cuban diaspora. With me here in studio is percussionist Daphnis Prieto, who's also a MacArthur Fellow, a winner of the Genius Award, and he teaches at the University of Miami's Frost School of Music. Daphnis, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Also joining us from the public radio station KQED, excuse me, in San Francisco, pianist and composer Omar Sosa. He's been nominated for 7 Grammys, and they're both going to be performing this week. Omar, it's such a pleasure. Thanks again.
Well, it's my pleasure. Hello, Daphne. How are you?
Hola, Marco. ¿Cómo anda? How
are
you doing?
¿Cómo está, papá? Aquí, mira, en el otro lado. Un poco de frío, pero bien.
All the way out in San Francisco. Let me yes. start. You know what, Omar? Let me start with you. What kind of music did you grow up with in Cuba?
Well, I need to say, yeah, every Sunday in my house, my father used to listen Count Basie, Glenn Miller, and actually Duke Ellington and Nat King Cole. I grew up basically with that music. Besides the traditional Afro-Cuban music, you know, Irakere, Aragon, La Orquesta Enrique Jorrin, you know. Well, basically. This was my very beginning.
Yeah. When did you start playing instruments?
Well, at the age of 4. Yeah. I remember in our school, they have a marching band, and the first time I saw a drum, I say, well, you know, I would like to play something, and they give me the redoblante, the snare. And I start playing. Of course, I don't play like Daphne, but 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 I start as a percussion player. I have a classical degree, but you know, Cuba have really good drummers. You know, yeah, one of them is close to you now.
Well, and, you know, no, go ahead.
Yes?
Yeah, go ahead. No, continue.
No, well, you know, And certainly, you know, I try to play a marimba and vibraphone, but in Cuba we have a little difficulty with find the instrument. And I look around and I saw, yeah, I saw the piano always out of tune, but I saw the piano, and I say, well, you know, I want to be a musician, and now it's too late to switch, you know. And I get the great fortune to play with the great drummers. I play, yeah, actually with Daphne too. We did some concert in Barcelona a long time ago with Ernesto Simpson, with Horacio El Negro, Raúl Pineda. I can mention Julio Barreto. Well, Daphne can talk. Yeah, can talk well, better about the drummers well, than me.
Well, I'll tell you what. No. You know what, Daphne? So let me ask you. Let me start with this. Is you know, what kind of music were you growing up with? What was playing in the house?
In the house, not necessarily, but around in the neighborhood, I grew up in a poor neighborhood, which was I was around the music, and I used to listen to rumba all the time around my house, and I used to sneak into people's houses rehearsals, and the carnival, the soon it gets closer to the summer, the carnival start rehearsing like two blocks from my house. They used to actually parade right in front of my house during the rehearsal time. So all that environment, the musical, artistic environment, was I was around it, and I really, you know, kind of grasp all of that.
When did you actually start playing?
I started playing when I was 6 years old, the guitar. I started playing guitar, and then I switched to the bongos, and then eventually I started in the fine school of arts doing classical percussion.
And did you also, you studied classical and jazz at the conservatory?
No, jazz, only classical. In Cuba, they only teach you classical music.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Omar?
Yeah, Daphne. Mm-hmm. You know, say by that time, if they catch you listen some jazz, some jazz music, they put you out of the school.
Is that?
Well, by actually, this by was my time.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're a little bit in a different generation. You're the generation that got that in the shoulders. By the time I was in the school, that wasn't really that much of a taboo anymore. In the school.
So wait, let me get this straight. So Omar, when you were in school, you couldn't listen to jazz? You couldn't play jazz? It was forbidden?
No. You know what? You know what? Because it was the music of the enemy. And it was kind of crazy. You know, yeah, I remember, you know, we have a little radio. It's FM radio. It's called Juvenil 80. You know, it's the little radio. But we have the opportunity to grab some station. It's come from Miami. And later night, we put the station, and we listen some American jazz. But by that time, we have only one jazz program in Cuba. It was made by Horacio El Negro's father. It was at 11 o'clock. ¿Tú te acuerdas de eso, Daphne?
Yeah, como no. Yeah, sí.
So Daphne, when you were coming up then, did that change?
Yeah, that changed already. In my generation, we already could afford to play any kind of music at the school. And we actually had like five or six different bands, jazz bands. And that was a great gift for us all. But the generation previously than mine, they did suffer that situation of not playing. They wanted to have a very restricted, academic information there in the school. So they didn't allow, even sometimes Cuban music wasn't allowed to be played at the school because the regime was very, very strict. It was coming from Russia and from the Eastern European. So we kind of adopted that disciplinary attitude, but at the same time, you know, we come from a completely different culture than these guys come from. So that was a very strange, but at the same time, very, I would say, a very magnified way to actually put it, because we got the technique from these guys, the classical technique from the Eastern Europeans, and then we have on top of it our unbelievable, powerful culture. So that combination really, it created, wonderful musicians after all.
Daphne, how do you describe the rhythms that make up Afro-Cuban percussion and what makes it unique?
Well, what it makes, there are different kind of rhythms. I mean, what it makes it unique is that they all kind of sincerely speak. You know, people in Africa used to use the instrument as a language, the music as a language. So there are some certain codes in different cultures that main African culture arrived to that have different combinations of other rhythms. If you play this one, then we go to a different rhythm. So it's kind of a language in a way. And to me, that's one of the most interesting things that happens in this culture, because the rhythmic culture is very sophisticated. It's not only doing the accompanying on something else. It speaks on its own and has an unbelievable, powerful value musically on its own. It's not music for accompanying anyone else. I mean, obviously you can, and it has been done, but you know, there are a lot of cultures that we inherit from Africa. You know, Afro-Cuban music is really African music that landed in Cuba and stayed in Cuba, and we kind of adopted that. And then, you know, little by little, the evolution of it, it created what we call now Cuban music, you know.
Again, I'm talking with percussionist Daphnis Prieto, and also joining us from KQED in San Francisco is pianist and composer Omar Sosa. And we're talking about the Global Cuban Fest that starts Sunday in Miami. We'll have more information, by the way, on our website. We'll take a quick break, come back, and talk a little bit more about that show coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Again, spending this time here talking about the upcoming Global Cuban Fest. It starts Sunday in Miami, featuring the music of the Cuban diaspora. And also, I wanted to just mention, I'm speaking with percussionist Daphnis Prieto. He is a MacArthur Fellow, winner of the Genius Award, teaches at the University of Miami's Frost School of Music. Also joining us from KQED in San Francisco, pianist and composer Omar Sosa, nominated for 7 Grammys. You know what? So my understanding, Omar, you came to the U.S., you settled in San Francisco, Daphnis, you moved to New York, mm-hmm. and you both got involved in Latin jazz. And I'm wondering how the jazz scenes were at the time when you were there. Omar, I'll start with you. What was going on when you got to San Francisco?
Well, when I arrived here, the Latin scenes actually was alive, you know, because we have a great master here like John Santos, John Calloway, Wayne Wallace, Michael Spiro, and I remember, you know, they give me the opportunity to be inside of their team, and you know, I just brought what I did in Cuba by that time. Actually, before I came here, I was in Spain before, and actually I was in Mexico before.
Uh-huh.
So San Francisco, actually Daphne was around here with all band they used to have. It's called Columbia, mm-hmm. Columna Bay.
Yes,
you were in San Francisco.
Yeah, I remember. Yes, when I arrived here, Daphne with the band he used to play with, they used to have here. So was a lot of movement. It come here, you know. All the rumbero used to come. I remember one of the great rumberos, Pancho Quinto, is like I call the Coltrane de la Rumba. Yeah, he used to come a lot here. Yeah, and the scene was a turn. Actually, Daphne can talk a lot about this too because he was part of this too.
Mm-hmm. So Daphne, you started off in San Francisco before you got to New York?
No, that's not. No, well, I used to visit a lot. I visit a lot to the West Coast, mostly because we in the band that we were, we actually visit a lot the Stanford University to doing some residencies and stuff like that. So I used to play in a band that was named Columna Bay. And that band used to travel around the U.S. and stuff like that. And then after that, I decided to come to New York. So so it was after where I met actually Omar in the West Coast, and we were playing in the festival. Omar was playing in a festival there, I believe so, right, Omar, in the San Francisco Jazz Festival. And then we were playing also, but that was like maybe a year or 2 years before. I stayed and I, you know, I was living in Cuba then, and then I came back and I went to New York in 1999.
What's the difference in the scenes at the time, you know, on the East Coast compared to what you saw on the West Coast?
Well, it's different. I mean, It's hard to be to make those differences. I wouldn't get into that much details. I don't want to.
Here was more relaxed.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to offend any or make any specification that might not be liked by any of the other sides. But you know, to me, you know, obviously New York contains that kind of roughness, that kind of edgy. Yeah. That edgy attitude in the way people live, so therefore in the music as a consequence of it. And that's the same thing on the other side. It happens on the West Coast. It's much more relaxed, much more, you know, expanded. Therefore, it's a different kind of, music. I think we got a little bit more of an avant-garde and contemporary mm-hmm. music coming from New York than from the West Coast. From the West Coast, a little bit more conservative in a way. Musically speaking.
So I don't think you insulted anybody. I think you're okay with that.
Yeah.
Omar, your new album, Transparent Water, is a collaboration with a Senegalese musician. Because yes. you bring in a lot of elements from around the world. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, for all my career, basically, I try to put people together. You know, I believe in a... in a conversation, I believe in a sharing scenes. I believe in learn about different traditions, different cultures, and present your tradition, and it's always it's come out something interesting in my point of view, and this new record, Transparent Water, with Sekou Keita, is from Senegal. He played kora and percussion, and he's a singer. He have this griot tradition of a history teller, and for me it's really important to listen the tradition or how people can translate tradition and put together with another one like I say before, and with this record. You know, we try to present the, let's say, the space and the silence is into African music with some instrument like a kora. The kora is the African harp. It's one of the most sublime instrument. Yeah, this is what the instrument with the kings used to use. To say what they're gonna present to their people, and with this new record, yeah, basically, it's a combination of Cuba, Venezuela, India, Japan, China, Korea, and Senegal, and the fundamental thing is space, silent, and unity between everybody, and we pay tribute to the water, because it's one of the most fundamental, if not the fundamental element in our planet.
If I may, real quickly, in the short time that I have, Daphnis, I wanted to ask you real quickly too. You're recording now with a big band.
I just did. Record is coming out on April 6th. The recording is already ready.
Why did you want to do this big complex?
Well, I always I've written a few things for big band before for a commission for other big bands, but now I wanted to take this journey and really personalize a full album of my own music with my arrangement, and there it is. I had a great time. I'm very pleased with the results of it. It's my music. Yes.
This is the new one?
That's the new one. That's right there.
Okay. It's Back to the Sunset is what it's called.
Yes.
And just, you know, I wanted to again just mention real quickly that we have the performance that's coming up starting Sunday, the Global Cuban Fest. It starts Sunday in Miami. And I've been talking with Daphnis Prieto. He's a MacArthur Fellow. He teaches at the University of Miami's Frost School of Music. And we've also been talking with Omar Sosa, seven-time Grammy nominee. He was talking to us from the public radio station KQED in San Francisco. He's a pianist and composer. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And I do want to mention, Daphnis, we did. I found some of your music. I know it's not from your new album, but mm-hmm. let's go out with a little bit of this. I think it was just a solo project you were doing. I just enjoyed watching it. Anyway, that's the program for today. I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, you can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or on Twitter, at WLRN Sundial. Let us know anything about the show, if you have any questions or comments. That's the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. I'm just going to stop because this is. I love listening to this. I can listen to this all day. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you again on Monday.